Hello and welcome to The Book Show. Peter Mayers with you this week while Ramona Koval has a mid-year break. Today, the future of libraries and the future of librarians. Do we still need them when we can access books and journals online? And in its effort to move with the times, has the modern library lost its reputation as a place of quiet reading and research? Libraries aren't what they used to be. I grew up being hush-hushed in the library. It was a quiet space and a place dedicated unambiguously to books, from dusty old hardbacks to recent releases with that crisp new book smell. These days, my municipal library has a very different feel. The books are still there, of course, but there's also a range of activities on offer. Not just story time for toddlers and homework help for high school students, but adult classes on diverse topics. I know of one library teaching a course on how to sell your stuff on eBay, for example. And for kids, and indeed for some adults, the attraction of the library may lie as much in the various computer games on offer at terminals from Xbox to Wii as it does in reading. So what's happening to our libraries, and what's the future of the library in a digital age? To discuss these questions, I'm joined from our Perth studios by Catherine Greenhill. She's a special librarian at the Cottesloe Peppermint Grove Mosman Park Library, who's looking forward to moving into a brand new building that is clearly embracing the future. Catherine Greenhill, welcome to The Book Show.
Good morning.
And in Melbourne, I'm joined by Dr. Ian McShane. Ian's a researcher from Swinburne University, from the Institute of Social Research, and he's looking at the challenges the large modern public library faces in the 21st century. Ian McShane, welcome to The Book Show.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning.
Ian, what was your first early library experience as a child?
Well, I grew up in country Tasmania, so I was dependent on mobile library services, which still exist and indeed flourish in parts of Australia.
So this is a van that would come round?
That's correct, yes. Although I have to say that my first real memory of a library is a rather disappointing one. It's being turned away from the circulation desk with a book that I wanted to take out. This was on a visit to the Hobart Library. I was an early reader, perhaps a precocious reader, and I do quite clearly recall being told that the book I wanted to take out wasn't suitable for me.
Do you remember what it was?
No, I don't.
But clearly too adult for your tender age.
Yes, in the librarian's view, that's right.
Well, librarians can be censorious or have a reputation. Perhaps that's something we'll come to, because I think that's one of the things that, one of the kind of images we have of the library that is in itself outdated. Catherine Greenhill, what about you? What are your early memories of libraries?
I was a country girl, and our library was open on every second Tuesday afternoon. And it was a small room in the Soldiers Memorial Hall. And I remember I didn't live too far from the library, so I was allowed to go by myself in those days. And I just remember the absolute anticipation on the day that library would be open. And when I discovered I could get a book ordered in from anywhere in the state, everything just opened up for me.
That must have been a landmark discovery, because I imagine that the Memorial Hall tomes would have run out of reading fairly quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I know that the library staff were extremely tolerant, because I was there saying, is it in yet? Is it in yet? Do you have such and such in yet? Because I was so excited by it. And just, you know, in a small country town, and I'm sure that Ian had the same experience, what you're exposed to there is limited, and what the library opened up for me was boundless.
I wonder if the fact that you both had, in a way, limited access to library resources has made you passionate about libraries in your adult life, Ian?
It's fascinating to speculate. We had books at home. My parents subscribed to the Reader's Book Club, so I grew up with stirring stories of journeying from Cape Cod to Cape Hot and stories of the Second World War. But the library did open a world for me that continues to fascinate and engage me. I worked for a good time in and around cultural institutions, and I researched them. And perhaps it was both the early limitations and then the subsequent exposure that set me on that path.
Catherine?
I think the thing for me is that because I was thinking last night, you know, what is this new library we're building got in common with my experience as a child? And I thought, It's to do with nobody was telling me what to read, what to do. It was my space to do whatever I wanted with. And there are very few institutions when you're coming from school, for example, where you're told, you know, you're programmed almost every minute of the day. You go to this place and it's connecting you to the world in whichever way you want to be connected. And I think that that possibility is still something that I very much see continuing through to libraries today and one of our amazing strengths.
That sense of excitement. Ian McShane, are we big library users as a nation?
Yes, we are. About, I think, just under half of Australians have a library membership. Libraries are, in fact, the most widely spread public institutions in the country. About 1,500 points of service as points of library service are around the country. That equates to between 400 and 500 libraries. Most of library usage, of course, as we've spoken about, is at municipal level. We tend to focus on the national and the state libraries and the large specialist libraries, but really it's at your local library where most of the action is, and in some ways where the greatest challenges are.
That they're the libraries that most people use most of the time, and indeed then where you get the, I suppose, the clashes of interest and so on, we might come to talk about a bit further. Catherine Greenhill, now you're about to move into a brand new library building, I think. Tell us, because I suppose this is a physical manifestation of the library of the future or a library that's planned for the future. Tell us about the new library you're moving into.
Yes, well, when you introduced me, you heard that I was from the Cottesloe Peppermint Grove Mosman Park Library, which we're doing away with as a name now. It's a product of three councils, and we've got a 40-year-old building that has served the needs for 40 years very well. But we're moving into a new building, and we're going to have to provide services for at least the next 40 years. So one of the things we've done is it's expressed within the building as we've got green precincts funding, so we've got environmentally sustainable design. So our rainwater is going to be potable, for example, so we're producing the rainwater on the site where we've got a thermal maze underneath which is going to provide heating and cooling. And the idea is that the building itself becomes an education centre for the environmentally sustainable design. So we're having windows so you can actually see in and see how the building works. But inside also, we're changing. And what we're wanting to do is, our vision is really to be the community's lounge room. And so we're co-located with a number of other facilities, like we've got a child health clinic there. We'll have a couple of community rooms, and one of the community rooms will have a little kitchen with a camera over the top so you can actually see what somebody's cooking, and it will be projected onto a screen.
This is a kind of MasterChef goes local library.
Exactly.
I can imagine people coming in and tell me I'm not cutting the onion small enough or something.
Exactly. And the idea is also to have an indoor-outdoor feel to it, because being in Western Australia, we can do that. So it's north-facing, but, for example, off our children's section, it opens straight onto this beautiful big wooden deck. So we're going to have outside furniture there so the mums can sit there and congregate and have that really important social connection when you've been up all night with small children. Go gather, watch your children have story time, use the area, and also have that social aspect as well.
You describe it as the lounge room. What about things like, you know, having a coffee and a snack and things like that?
Absolutely. Throughout the building, we're quite happy for people to bring in their own food, to buy from the cafe, to eat wherever.
To bring the food in amongst the books?
We are under no illusions that people are treating our books when they take them home as pristine artefacts and never opening them in the bathtub or at the dinner table. We won't be allowing bathing in the new library, I might add, but, well, you know, we've got no illusions.
It is a good point, I guess. We think, you know, can't mix food and books, but I suspect there's a fair few people who'd read the books over breakfast or over dinner. Now, I believe this new library was going to be called, or one suggestion was to have it called, the Very Clever Library, but the name, in fact, is going to be the Grove Leading Learning Living. So the word library has even disappeared.
It has. That's because it's a co-located facility. So we've got the West Coast Community Centre, the Learning Centre there. We've got the Child Health Clinic there, and we've got the community rooms there. So the library is one big element, and the library was a driving force towards making this new facility. But it's part of the entire venture, and we thought that actually calling it the Very Clever Library wouldn't take in all the other things that this facility is going to be for our community.
Ian McShane, is this a kind of global trend, or is the Cottesloe, Peppermint Grove, Mosman Park community out on a bit of a limb here?
Yes, it is a global trend, but it's not a new trend. The most popular libraries in 19th century Australia were in mechanics institutes. They were reading rooms. They weren't termed libraries. The term library itself has been embellished in one way or another. On the way here this morning, I passed what used to be the Flemington Hygienic Library, which was a subscription library that rail commuters could check books in and out of, books that were disinfected daily. So that
that was why it was called the Hygienic Library.
Yes.
It was a private institution? Or?
Yes, it was a private business. Mechanics institutes were subscription libraries, but they were subsidised by state governments. So the concept of the library has been embellished or changed. There was considerable debate over the opening of a place called the Idea Store in Tower Hamlets in London, defended vigorously by its proponents as a way of encouraging new uses and new imaginings of the library. But libraries now are centrepieces of urban redevelopment. Catherine spoke about her old library about being about 40 years old and being out of date. Now, that's a period of time when lots of Australia's social infrastructure was built, and it has come to the end of its useful life. And the library model itself, which was based on the concept of acquiring a physical collection, has come to the end of its useful life, or at least been supplemented. It could be at point we discuss further and perhaps debate. But yes, I think that it's very true. I mean, at the same time, the concept of the library is a very trusted one. It is one of the most trusted public institutions around the world, and I wouldn't be dispensing with it lightly. I wouldn't be so crass as to call it a brand, but certainly it's very significant. It speaks to concepts of the public realm and the importance of the public domain.
Shared space, civility, all those ideas.
Yes.
We might come back to some of those issues about the role of the library in society a bit further on in our discussion. This is the book show on ABC Radio National discussing the future of the municipal library, and it's the changing nature of the library. And as we've heard, libraries are becoming much more than places where you borrow books or sit and read. Let's pay a visit to a local library. Springvale Library in the outer southeastern suburbs of Melbourne is a fairly typical large public library servicing a community of about 19,000 people from pretty diverse backgrounds. The book show's Anita Barrow visited the Springvale Library on a busy Saturday afternoon.
Hello, do you have a library card?
Wow, you've got a big book. You've got Explore Australia. Is that for a school project?
Yes. I'm going to do some writing.
Yes, I'm Natalie Brown. I'm the Library Services Coordinator for the City of Greater Dandenong Libraries.
And you're the manager of the Springvale Library here. This is one of the branches.
Yes, it's located quite well here on Springvale Road for the community to access. As you can sort of see, it's quite busy.
Very it's extremely busy,
yeah,
library.
Yeah.
And in fact, what's the busiest corner, I have to say,
yes,
is the consoles.
That's right.
You've got, how many computers have you got here? Quite a few.
We've got 17 public access PCs, and as you can see, they're pretty much all being used.
Just playing games.
What kind of games?
Shooting, killing each other.
What's your favourite game?
Counter-Strike.
Counter-Strike. What do you do with the Counter-Strike?
Just shoot. You just shoot each other.
Do you have a computer at home?
Yeah, but no internet.
I might just ask this lady next to you.
I look up items of interest from Bombay and general interest. Right now I'm reading about the Socceroo. So it's become like my lifeline. Like, I live alone, so if I were not to come here, I would be depressed. So I feel good surrounded by the kids.
I'm studying IT online and one day on TEF.
I'm starting to like the noise. Initially, I used to get irritated. I'm reminded of my grandkids and I love it here.
So do you have some relationships with the kids around you? You see regular kids?
They help
kids?
Me out all the time. They know more than I know.
We find instead of the kids going to, say, you know, the local up the road to the shops, we find that they congregate here.
Do you have quiet places here?
There are a few quiet reading places sort of against the window, and we've got a bit of another sort of study area.
You look very busy. I'm sorry to disturb you.
Fine.
What's your name?
Linda.
Yeah, I'm preparing for an exam.
Yeah.
What year are you?
I'm in year 12.
Do you come to the library very often?
Every Saturday, just to help revise, do my homework, things like that, yeah.
And why the library? Why not at home?
Because there's no distractions at the library. You know, I just sit here, do some work, and nobody to bother me or anything like that. No siblings or the computer to, like, distract my, yeah.
What we find is when people are doing research, they'll start with Google or Wikipedia, and then they'll come to us and they're unable to, you know, to find the information or to find more authoritative sort of information to assist them with their inquiry. One of the things we also do is teach people how to use the internet.
Do you actually point them to books as well?
Yes. If a child's doing a project and we can answer their inquiry through a book, we will.
Do you still do? I mean, a lot of libraries have, you know, the 10 best reads, and I like this book because, and this person writes like that. If you like this book, then you might like this one.
Yes, we do. We do have that service available, and we've got a Read and Relax blog on the internet, on our website, and that has that type of information. And the librarians use it while they're serving customers and helping people find what they want to read.
Do you like the library?
No, but the library is good. I like it. That's okay. I like it.
I like it.
Very much.
My much.
Hi.
So do you come to the library very often?
Yeah, often. I have no work at the moment, so then I come often. Yeah.
Thank you. What books did you get out? Blast Off, Aussie Nibbles. Do you like reading?
Yeah.
And do you come to the library a lot?
Yeah, often.
That's yours.
10 days.
Check some of these out as well. So I'll just. Okay. You all right with that? Thank you very much. Okay, see you later.
Librarian Natalie Brown checking out books and DVDs at the Springvale Library in outer suburban Melbourne. Anita Barreau is our reporter. I'm Peter Mayers, and my guests in the book show are Catherine Greenhill, a special librarian at the Cottesloe Peppermint Grove Mosman Park Library, and Dr. Ian McShane, a researcher from the Institute for Social Research at Swinburne University in Melbourne. And Catherine, one of the issues that immediately came up there is a bugbear for many people in libraries, and that's the issue of noise. Is noise a big issue for your library?
Well, because we're moving into a new facility, we're renegotiating all that territory. So at the moment, no, it's too small for lots of people to come and congregate for a long time. It can be an issue in libraries when the function that people expect it to have meets the function that people want it to have for the future. We will have rooms where people can be quiet, but sometimes it can be a bit like having a non-smoking area in a plane. It's great in principle, but it doesn't particularly work as a barrier.
No, because the plane's too small, so the smoke just drifts down anyway, and the noise tends to have that capacity to get under doors and through windows and walls.
However, if you think about the image of librarians, the first thing that comes up is the idea of shushing.
Indeed.
And I don't know how many people would be put off by that idea and feel like they were unwelcome in the facility. So actually the idea that you're not going to be shushed, you're going to be able to make noise, have your little kids there, may well be more amenable to more of our users than the idea of having a hallowed silent space where you can't be yourself.
Ian McShane, it's a difficult balancing act, isn't it? I know there's been a debate here in Melbourne about the domed reading room at the State Library of Victoria. And you've written about this in the online journal Inside Story, and listeners will find a link to that on our website. We had people like researcher Leslie Canold, who had, I think, escaped her teenagers at home only to find that the library itself was dominated by teenagers as well. I think Helen Garner, the writer, has also complained that she wrote her first novel in the reading room, but she can't write there now. She's had to hire a separate place to work.
Yes, it has been a lively debate in Melbourne, and it is an issue in particular for smaller municipal libraries where, as Catherine said, it's more difficult to separate the different activities that libraries are engaged in, and that is precisely the point, that libraries do have such a range of activities that they are confined by their physical space. I mean, I would have to do a little special pleading here. I spend my professional life in and around libraries and archives, working in particular with special collections or the sort of collections that the general library users won't access on a regular basis. They can indeed, and that is one of the great virtues of the library.
But they're things you have to ask for, or you have to look up specialist types of resources.
They are, and you need to use them in the library, and in order to spend the sort of time you need with them, the sort of studied deep reading, you do need silence, or at least something approaching it. I think that this is a question that will continue to be debated, but I think in all of this we need to understand that the nature of reading itself is changing somewhat. Particularly for young people who are more interested in the notion of social reading and less interested in quiet, private, reflective reading. That is, they want to share texts, they want to participate in them, they want to create them, mash them up. That sort of reading and that sort of literacy, I think, is something that libraries are engaging with, but it is posing strains on their physical facilities.
It's that notion of, I mean, how embedded is that notion of quiet, deep, reflective reading, which is, I suppose, one that, I mean, I grew up with, and one that is often associated as the dominant form in the library.
Yes, well, it's been with us for a few hundred years, perhaps since the development of printing and the spread of literacy, but it's also associated with a particular form of religious and ethical development, a development of the reflective self. It is the foundation of mass education systems, but digital technologies and the internet and mobile communications are changing that and changing it quite dramatically. I don't think that it's a question of one or the other. I think that these different versions of reading and of literacy are complementary in many ways, and libraries are struggling to try and accommodate that.
Mm. Catherine Greenhill.
I think some of it is actually based on the scarcity of the physical artefact, which, yes, it can be still an issue, but with digitisation, some of those rarer texts being digitised, if one is after the contents, then one can do it in the quiet of one's rented room via the net to peruse the library's materials, and you don't actually have to be physically in the library. And by the same token, if you actually like listening to thrash metal while you read your sacred artefacts, you can do that too if it's digitised. So you can actually set the environment in which you read, and you have much more control now.
Yeah, and I think you want to...
Well, yes, I think that's very true, and I think that what digitisation has done and the library's use of digital resources has done has boosted the access of some of those collections, particularly the rare and fragile collections. Mm-hmm. The National Library of Australia's newspaper digitisation project is a very interesting project that I've been doing a little research on, which has brought 19th century newspapers to much greater readership. But never underestimate the importance of the artefact itself.
About turning those old crinkly pages or whatever it may be.
But also the information that lies outside the content, the digital content. You know, if a letter has a faint whiff of vinegar, it may have been quarantined because it's been through a country with typhoid. That's an example that Robert Darnton from the New Yorker gives on observing a researcher sniffing letters in the New York Public Library.
Fantastic. Look, I want to come back to the municipal library and I suppose the competing uses. We've talked about noise, but one of the things I've noted in my own library has been the advent of the computer game. First of all, it was just one sort of PC with console with some games, and then there was an Xbox and then a Wii. And in fact, you know, there's now quite a range of different consoles, and no doubt that's a way of getting young people into a library. But Catherine, some people say, well, what's the point? What's the point of getting young people into a library to play video games?
Well, some people actually argue it's a gateway drug, and I'd argue it's more than that. So it definitely does work that way, as in people come for the social gaming aspect. I can compete with other people in this area, not just in my school, not just my friends, but other people of my age, which is kind of a nice thing if you're geeky and you don't play soccer. But then the kids are actually going to the shelves and taking out the books, and we've got stats that back that up from the US and from here.
So there is evidence that gateway drug works. They do get addicted to the written word as well.
Absolutely, but that's not actually necessarily our aim to take more to have more books borrowed. That type of stat, I don't think, talks about the real value of the library. Just being able to have a place to go and to connect with your community is as valuable as having more books borrowed. However, there's also the concept of transliteracy, where for my kids, Harry Potter isn't just a novel by J.K. Rowling. It's actually a number of Lego sets that have Harry Potter figures in. It's also a online Wii game based on Lego characters, based in the Harry Potter world, which is also based in the movie world. And I think that kids don't necessarily see the worlds of reading being created in just a single corresponding print book artifact. It's actually more a world that's created with a number of channels in. And gaming for kids is very much an important way into, if you like, that world that they read in a way that's really different to how you or I are used to reading.
How do we define then the success of a library? I mean, is it success in the number of books borrowed or the number of people who come through the door? And is a library then more a community centre, Ian McShane, than a library as such?
Well, even if you were to define success by the number of people who come through the door, there are different measures of it. The Australian Bureau of Statistics counts visitors, but the library sector counts visits. So if you were to cross the threshold half a dozen times during the day, you might rack up 6 visits for the State Library of Victoria. Now, that is a real live example because it translates to arguments for funding and so forth. I think success, and particularly success in the 21st century for libraries, will be across 3 areas. Firstly, it will be to the extent with which they can demonstrate they're preserving cultural memory. The second is the way they're engaging with informal education and literacy and changing notions of literacy. And the third is the citizenship and community aspect. Mm. And I think libraries are actually doing very well on each of those counts. I'm not sure that governments are quite recognising that, and I think that there are new investment arguments that need to be put to governments to ensure libraries' continued success.
Well, I'd like to interrogate a couple of those ideas you mentioned there, and I was taken in the example we heard from Springvale of one woman saying, well, I come to the library a lot at the moment because I'm between jobs. So she might be one of those visitors coming back 6 or 7 times a day. And I see that at my local library. I see people who come to read the papers, possibly because they can't afford to read the papers, possibly because it's warm in a cold Melbourne winter or cool in a hot Melbourne summer. Is that an important, Catherine, an important aspect of the library in providing that shared resource for people who... Mm. Yep.
One of the most important things, that we're coping with at the moment is in our new library, you know, the old imposing library desk where the librarian stands behind gatekeeping.
Absolutely.
We're getting rid of that.
The ones who told Ian McShane he couldn't borrow the book because it was too old for him.
Those ones who say now, hey, it's the parents' responsibility, not ours. We trust you. But we're getting rid of that desk. But that desk in our library at the moment plays a really big role in that people walk through the door and they say hi or they nod, and they might not actually be acknowledged anywhere else in their society throughout the day, except in a shop maybe, except when they come into the library and they get that regular nod and hello. And sometimes we know, I'm very sure there's some people who are coming in and that's actually the main attraction, is being told that they're a person. And we're going to have to work really hard, given that we're getting rid of that big imposing desk, to actually continue just that informal eye contact, hello, how are you, you exist, you're connected to your community. So there is no doubt, librarians sometimes joke about who we social work, as in there'll be particular patrons who develop a fellow feeling with a particular librarian who tell them about what's going on in their lives. Yeah. And you know these are lonely people and you're fulfilling a real need. And I think that any librarian who thinks they're there just connecting books to the public and don't acknowledge that and don't somehow find a way to make that part of our business case is going to be doing a disservice to their libraries.
Ian McShane, another thing that came out for me from the Springvale example was an older woman saying when she was asked about the noise that kids make, she talked about how the kids helped her because they would help her. She was obviously from a non-English background. They would help her negotiate the library and find things. Now, that raises another of the notions you've talked about, which is the notion of civility, if you like, and a shared kind of negotiation of space and common use. And this has been an important part of the notion of the library for a long time, hasn't it?
It has, and it continues to be an important one, perhaps increasingly important as technology, let's say, intrudes into the library. It becomes more personalised. People bring mobile phones in and are quite happy to have conversations with somebody distant. That example, of course, also points to the increasing diversity, cultural diversity of society, which is a challenge for libraries. To what extent do they need to have on staff people who speak other languages? What sort of stock do they acquire and keep that relate to the source countries of Australia's migration, the community languages that are spoken in a particular region? But I think increasingly as we rely on digital technologies, we use libraries to access the internet, then there's a sort of peer learning that goes on. People will share their knowledge with other people. Librarians aren't necessarily the best people to do that. They may not necessarily have the skills and the demands may far exceed the supply. So, yes, I think not only civility but also that notion of informal and peer and social learning is very important in libraries.
And Catherine, does this have implications for the way librarians are trained? I mean, are librarians adequately trained to deal with the complex range of tasks they have, not just checking out books, as you say, but also perhaps relating to lost and lonely people?
Well, I think we need to understand that what we do is we connect people and information. And sometimes you're going to be more focusing on connecting information to information so that people can get to it, which is kind of the cataloguing side of it. Sometimes you're going to be focusing more on connecting people to people, which is the peer support that you're talking about, so that they can gain their information. Sometimes it'll be the stamping the book, the people and the information. But I think that it's no different to what we've been teaching for years and years, which is you've got to love and know about people. You've got to love and know about information and the cultural history and find new and different ways to put them together. One of the examples that I really love is in New Zealand, there's a online project called Kiti, and it's started as Kiti Harafania, which is a small town where the librarian said, hey, look, all these people are putting information about what they've got for sale on the New Zealand auction site. They're creating all this data. Can the library work in a way to help people create data about their own stories? So instead of creating an auction site, they created a story site, a history site, where the library's role is to get the platform up, to train people how to do it. But now the community is putting up photographs and stories and training each other and can comment, hey, that's the house that I grew up in that you've just put in there. Let's comment. And they're actually creating connection and connecting people and information. So as long as people remember that core, I think that the training that we've been doing can continue into the future. It's just the examples and how we're executing it, if you like, is changing.
And what about the books in libraries? Will there always be books in libraries? Because I think, Catherine, you're already at your library already lending e-books.
We lend a single Kindle, and we got it just before Christmas. We're in quite a well-off area, and so what we wanted to do is give them a chance to try before you buy, because, of course, at Amazon you only see it online, you can't see it in the shops. But also our aim was to position ourselves so when people thought e-books, they thought library. as in they thought, these are the people who have always told me what I could read next with my print books. These might be the people who, when I want to get an e-book reader, could advise me about formats, about copyright, about where to get the best things, about what reads next, about what's available in Australia via e-book format. So some libraries in the eastern states and Queensland are actually lending e-books to their users. We're not doing that. We have a single Kindle, which is really a try before you buy, but also our kind of way of positioning ourselves for our community as something that's an asset when you think about e-books rather than something obsolete that you should bypass.
Ian, I guess e-books do pose a problem for the library because you don't have the physical object which you go and bring back and many people can use. If you let the e-book out, what's to stop you just spreading it around to anyone you like?
Well, it's true. I think that there will be significant resource constraints in terms of the upfront investment in e-books, but the capacity then to access books without the physical storage costs is fairly impressive. But one of the great ironies of e-books and portable readers is the extent to which they imitate the book itself. Never underestimate the cultural importance of books. Libraries have a responsibility to collect for the future, and I think that they do need to very seriously balance what they acquire in terms of continued standard physical books with digital and electronic sources.
Well, Ian McShane and Catherine Greenhill, thank you both very much for joining us to discuss libraries.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Catherine Greenhill is a special services librarian in Perth, and she also runs a blog about libraries, and we'll put links to that on the website. And Dr. Ian McShane is from the Institute for Social Research at Swinburne University and has been researching the role of public institutions, including libraries, in the 21st century.